Welcome to episode 37 of the Far Middle Podcast. This is Nick Deolius. I hope you're doing well. We are in early February of 2022, and today actually is Groundhog Day. So I am a big fan of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, but I got to be honest with you, I never understood the whole Groundhog Day series of events or the day itself. Don't understand it, but you know, hope that those that participated in it are having a good time today. Always wondered what aliens would think if they stumbled upon our planet in early February and looked down on Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, you know, what their take would be on what's going on with respect to Groundhog Day. Now, episode 37, instead of picking an individual athlete in football or baseball, hockey, basketball, like we've been doing in terms of dedications, I want to use episode 37 as an excuse to dedicate the episode to boxing. I think boxing is the sport that when it gets it right and when it's done well, it is the best sport by far. It just beats all the other sports in terms of product and just viewing enjoyment. Now, unfortunately, right, boxing more often gets it wrong than gets it right. So this is more of an exception based when boxing gets it right. But nevertheless, when things are done right and done well by boxing, it's just unbeatable in terms of the spectator nature of the sport. And then you look at eras of boxing. The 1970s and the early 80s, that was, you had boxing like it was never done before. It was just the golden era of boxing. I watched a lot of that during that era as a kid. That was my introduction. I sort of got spoiled because it was such an awesome era for boxing. And what a time, right, to be a boxing fan. And really, it can start with the heavyweights in the 1970s. And you can start with the greatest of the heavyweights of that era, Muhammad Ali. Now, Ali's not my favorite boxer of all time. He's actually not even my favorite heavyweight. But when you look at what he had done, what he had accomplished over the span of his career, and specifically in the ring, you got to give the nod to the guy as being the greatest. Now, Ali's record, career-wise, was 56-5. And of those 56 wins, 37 of them were career knockouts. So thus, I'm going to tie episode 37 of The Far Middle to Ali, his 37 career knockouts, to the golden era of heavyweight boxing, which was the 1970s. And that 70s era for the heavyweights, you know, again, not my favorite sort of weight class for boxing. My favorite weight class is somewhere in that middleweight, welterweight divisions. And I'll talk about that maybe at length at another episode of The Far Middle. The late 70s and early 80s was a golden era for those weight classes as well. But going back to the heavyweights in the 70s, you had Ali involved in two trilogies of fights with two other epic boxers and another single fight with a third that really sums up. I mean, just across that decade with just one fighter, Ali, and who his opponents were, you fit multi-generations of boxing history in a very short period of time. So just to sort of give you the chronology, in 1971, you had Ali Frazier 1. You know, that was dubbed the fight of the century. And this was a fight that Ali lost, and that was, I think, his first loss via decision. And Frazier in that fight, Joe Frazier was just relentless, and that's what I always loved about Joe Frazier. I mean, he took a bit of a beating, but, you know, in terms of his mode of attack, he just would never stop. Now, that was 71. In 73, Muhammad Ali fought Kenny Norton, and he lost that in a split decision. I think that was out in California in San Diego, and that's where Ali broke his jaw. So that was in 73 against Ken Norton. In 73, again, same year, right? So early 73, he loses to Norton, breaks his jaw. Later in 73, he fights Norton again. That's Ali Norton 2. And Muhammad Ali wins that one in a split decision, also out in California. I think that time it was in Los Angeles. Maybe it was in the Forum. I can't remember where it was at in LA. In 74, the next year, Ali has another go at Joe Frazier. So this is Ali Frazier 2. This was up in New York at Madison Square Garden. And Ali won that in a decision. Later in 74, this is two fights in the same year again, Ali fights George Foreman. That, of course, is the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire. There's an awesome book about that fight. It's called The Fight, written by Norman Mailer. And Norman Mailer is one of those interesting writers that followed sort of that group. He was in that group with Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Right Stuff. Awesome book, awesome author. Joan Didion, who's a great essayist, Slouching Towards Bethlehem is an awesome essay. If you ever get a chance, read some of her essays and collections of works. But Norman Mailer was sort of this angry, very aggressive type of a writer. And, you know, he sort of interjected himself in Zaire, mostly with the Ali camp, and wrote a book about it over the course of the couple weeks leading up to and during and right after the fight. really entertaining read. Give it a chance. Give it a read if you get a chance. Again, the title of it is The Fight. So that's 74, Rumble in the Jungle. And Ali wins that one, beats George Foreman. 75, you got Ali Frazier 3. That's the thriller in Manila. And he wins that one when Joe Frazier's trainer, right, he throws in the towel before the start of the 15th round. That's the fight where Ali said it was the closest thing to dying that he ever experienced. And he just, you could tell he found a lot of respect for Frazier after that fight. I don't really care for how Ali sort of belittled Frazier in the years prior to Ali Frazier 3 in Manila. But nevertheless, it seems like Ali sort of came around to a begrudging respect for Frazier after that trilogy of fights. And then in 76, you know, Ali Norton 3 happens at Yankee Stadium. That's a really interesting fight. If you get a chance to watch that on YouTube or on TV at some point, give it a watch, because Ali won that fight on a decision, but I think Norton clearly won that fight. I don't even think it was close. And I think Muhammad Ali even hinted at that when there was sort of like the post-press conferences and after the fight, he sort of hinted that, you know, he thought he lost the fight himself. But just look at that decade of 70s, and really the first half of the 70s, that's basically from 71 to 76, Ali going through Joe Frazier 3 times, right? Kenny Norton 3 times, George Foreman in the middle of all that. Just because of who he fought and the frequency that he fought them and the period of time that he did it, you sort of got to give the nod to Muhammad Ali as being the greatest ever. So on now with episode 37, now that we tied it into the 37 career knockouts of the great Muhammad Ali. Now, speaking of the greatest in boxing, we can jump to maybe the self-described greatest in the medical profession, which is Dr. Fauci. We'll spend a minute here on the Fauci focus. And this time I'm going to defend, I think, Dr. Fauci. I saw recently, maybe you've come across this, but there's a number of news stories, and it's on social media now, where people are sort of zooming in and trying to take a close look at different photos that are out there of Dr. Fauci when he's in his office, his home office or his work office, I'm not sure which or both. And they're trying to look at what's on his bookshelf and what's on his desk and what's on his walls. And the point of these stories were that on his walls, he's got some sort of art or painting of himself that someone did. And on his bookshelf or on his desk, he's got a bobblehead of himself. And people or in the media or social media, right, entities are basically saying he's a narcissist and that's a bad thing. And who does this guy think he is? And see, that's another reason not to like Dr. Fauci. Well, look, I mean, I don't see really anything wrong with that. You look at any professional athlete, particularly retired ones, right, when they're doing interviews from home on video or Zoom, on ESPN, wherever, it could be a broadcast. What do you always see? You see their jerseys framed up right on the walls. So you see their trophies displayed on a shelf. You go into a politician's office when you see them on camera, and you look at what's on their walls. There's pictures of them with other politicians or other heads of state. You go into a teenager's room, okay, and you look at what's on their walls. It's pictures of them with their friends. People like to see themselves in the context of things that they associate with. I think that's totally normal. And let's face it, if you or I had a bobblehead that was put out of ourselves, we probably would have one of those somewhere on a shelf, if nothing else, just for some humor that you'd want to display. So I don't see anything wrong with that. I know Dr. Fauci takes a lot of heat, and I think a lot of it is deserved with respect to what's going on with quote-unquote science and managing the pandemic and policy related to those things. But this is an area where, because somebody, you know, did a painting of him or his image and he's got it displayed on his wall, or there's a bobblehead of himself on his bookshelf, I mean, come on, that's a common, normal thing. I don't think that's any indication by any stretch that that's some sign of extreme narcissism. Now let's jump from a Fauci focus moment in episode 37 here to one of mask mania. We had a report that came out recently. You might have seen this or heard about it from NPR, which is that taxpayer-funded, beyond left-leaning mainstream news organization. And a journalist correspondent at NPR reported that Justice Gorsuch at the Supreme Court, on the Supreme Court, would not wear a mask when the court was in session. And that caused a concern from the perspective of Justice Sotomayor because she had a pre-existing condition. I believe it was diabetes, and didn't want to be in close proximity to someone who was not wearing a mask. And thus she attended the sessions via video feed, not in person. So the crux of the story was you had a conservative justice that refused to wear a mask despite the concerns or pleas of another justice who was a liberal justice and had a pre-existing condition. And then that resulted in basically the justices not being able to appear physically together when the court was in session. One had to do so remotely. Well, it turns out that the justices themselves refuted that story and what had happened. In fact, the Supreme Court put out a statement, and the statement said, quote, "Reporting that Justice Sotomayor asked Justice Gorsuch to wear a mask surprised us. It is false. While we may sometimes disagree about the law, we are warm colleagues and friends," end quote. So that was a joint statement from the Supreme Court and from Justices Gorsuch and Sotomayor. What's interesting about this is that comes out. Another journalist and correspondent at NPR basically comes out afterwards and says that at best, the statement from these two justices is false. So effectively calling them liars. And it just is really an interesting touch point, not so much in the context of what's going on with masks, but also in the context of what's happening and going on when it comes to journalism and journalistic standards or lack thereof, and journalism ethics or lack thereof in today's mainstream media. So a little bit of a mask mania moment, but not some of the ones that we're used to hearing about. One that actually is touched upon one of the highest, most esteemed institutions in the land, the Supreme Court of the United States, and one that definitely exemplifies what goes on today when it comes to standards or lack thereof when it comes to mainstream media. So let's jump from, you know, NPR, mainstream media, those institutions that are struggling in this twisty-turny world of the modern day, to another institution and a leader of it who is also going through some struggles, and that is the Catholic Church and Pope Francis. Now, we've talked about Pope Francis on a number of different episodes of The Far Middle. He's a subject, and the church is a subject of a chapter in my upcoming book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. But the recent sort of news that caught my eye with the Pope and the Catholic Church were some positions the Pope was taking and what some demographics are telling us as it relates to Catholicism in Latin America. So first, the Pope, what he was talking about, he recently was criticizing a couple of things. One was anti-vaccine ideology, so I don't think a big surprise there. But he was coming in and weighing on the need to take a critical eye towards ideology that's just anti-vaccine. But at the same time, he was also criticizing, and this was a surprising part for me, cancel culture. He used a term which I thought actually was pretty good. He called it ideological colonization. I have to remember that term, and I'm going to have to borrow that term that the Pope had came up with, because I think it is fitting. And that's something that he was ascribing to what was going on now with cancel culture. And what was interesting about this, here's a quote from the Pope. He said, quote, "Under the guise of defending diversity, cancel culture ends up canceling all sense of identity," end quote. So you can see where the Pope is going there and how that is a concern for him, cancel culture, that is. It's a concern for him when it comes to sort of the role that the church is playing and how its mission is set up in terms of Catholicism. So it's interesting to hear the Pope, who I would not have expected to be critical of something like cancel culture, and having actually some interesting views on it and coining that term ideological colonization. Now, what's interesting about this from my perspective is that the Pope is lamenting cancel culture and what he labels ideological colonization, yet he is as guilty of it as the next person, particularly since he is the spreader of anti-carbon ideology, which in my view is being anti-human. So here we are saying, hey, look, anti-vaccine ideology is not a good thing and cancel culture is not a good thing. Let's label those ideological colonization. So I'm with him on that. But then he turns around and he does the exact thing that he's criticizing when it comes to sort of embracing anti-carbon ideology, which is not helping Catholics, specifically poor Catholics all over the planet. So leaders, and particularly religious ones like Pope Francis, they need to practice what they preach, and they need to lead by example. So if you don't like ideological colonization in the context of cancel culture, in the context of anti-vaccine ideology, then let's not practice it and embrace it when it comes to carbon. And, you know, this anti-carbon ideology and the inability of the Pope to become less obsessed about it, it is taking its toll on Catholicism, especially in Latin America. There was an extensive article in the Wall Street Journal recently that was talking about how Catholicism is waning all across Latin America. And right now, in fact, it's actually before right now, I think it was a couple years back, maybe it was in 2018, there were five countries in Central America. I think there was a Caribbean country, Dominican Republic, if I recall, and then maybe Uruguay in South America that had a majority of non-Catholics a couple years back in 2018, which was a first. You never saw that in Latin America. And then Brazil, which is the largest Catholic country in the world, I think is expected to become minority Catholic as soon as this year. So whether it's Brazil, the largest example, the biggest Catholic country globally, or whether it's those other countries in Central America and Uruguay and South America and the Dominican Republic, Catholicism is definitely losing ground all over Latin America. And why is that? Well, I think there's a couple reasons why. One is, and Brazil's a good example of this, you've of course got some serious issues when it comes to poverty and quality of life all across Brazil, particularly in the bigger cities, but also right in the rural areas and in the Amazon area, et cetera. But when Pope Francis and the Catholic Church sort of convenes its sort of meetings when it comes to Latin America in the Amazon and Brazil, really the focus is not so much on the poor or finding ways to convert more individuals into Catholicism. The focus instead is more on the environmental side and recognizing there are environmental challenges when it comes to Latin America or Brazil or the Amazon. Nobody's disputing that. But putting that at the top of the priority list and where all the time is spent and the resources are spent when these convenings occur, that sends a message. And I think, you know, the people in Brazil or people in Latin America, they interpret that, they hear that and they interpret that. And that may not, that might in fact just turn them off to Catholicism. Meanwhile, you've got some competition, right? You got the evangelical movement, which is capturing a lot of those individuals across these different nations. And their message is one where, you know, you're not a bad person if you're dreaming big or if you want to, you know, make money or you want to create wealth for yourself or your family. That's not a bad thing. So the message from, you know, one sort of competing religion or form of Christianity is that achievement and success are not necessarily bad things, whereas maybe the message from the Catholic Church these days and from Pope Francis is that those things are items to be avoided, to be shunned, so to speak. So I think there's a couple of reasons as to why the Catholic Church is waning in Latin America. But you think about what that was at, where it was at from a demographic perspective and where it's at today and where it's going into the future. It's pretty stunning what's occurred under sort of the leadership of Pope Francis with Catholicism in Latin America. Now, the Pope isn't the only individual or entity that's guilty of spreading anti-carbon ideology. Unfortunately, we also have the Federal Reserve that's been guilty of that in Chairman Powell. We've got inflation, of course, that is raging all over the land, no signs of abating. That was missed by the Fed. They didn't see that coming. The PhD economists missed it. The sophisticated models all missed it. And we've also saw, you know, Chairman Powell, who was looking to audition to be reconfirmed by the Senate, and he was towing the line of the left when he was auditioning for that extension recently. And you just look at the track record of the Fed here recently. It wasn't enough, right, that the Fed has this now massive and very muddled mandate. You've got price controls and inflation and employment, stable currency, social justice, right, is now creeping into the Fed's mandate. So you've got all these massive things that it's looking to control and inform upon. And it's not enough that Chairman Powell and the Fed are more political than ever, okay, and not independent. I think everybody has seen that this veneer of independence has largely evaporated. Everybody sees the Fed for what it is. It's a political animal. No, now the Fed wants to be responsible for climate change and for weather. Chairman Powell's quote at that Senate hearing was climate change being of, quote, a very important priority, end quote, when it comes to the Fed and its policies and how he views its mandates and priorities. And what they were talking about were effectively stress tests that the Fed would impose upon the banks and the banking system. And stress tests that were designed to look at what extreme weather or changing weather patterns would do to the balance sheets of banks. Well, you know, stress tests are really a convenient tactic or tool for, in the end, to be able to starve domestic energy of capital and to punish those who lend to domestic energy. So this is nothing more than a blunt instrument under sort of a really interesting marketing shtick of, you know, stress tests and climate stress tests, et cetera. But basically what the aim is just to bluntly starve domestic energy of capital. And if you're going to lend to domestic energy, we're going to punish you for it if you're a bank. Now, what's interesting about this is that there was a study by the Fed itself, the New York Fed, that showed that extreme weather had a positive impact on banks' balance sheets because it led to more lending, which was a profitable endeavor for banks. But I don't think we're going to see much more of that study. That study is going to be deep-sixed and replaced with these climate stress tests, which I'm sure will show that every bank in the United States will go bankrupt, right, within a short period of time because of the pending doom of climate change. So you've had the Fed now, which is just completely whiffed and missed on inflation. You've got a Fed that's been using emergency measures since, 2009, and that's been over a decade now, well past a decade. The emergency never has seemed to gone away since the financial crisis of 2008-09. You have government that was unable, right, to predict a snowstorm that showed up in Virginia and shut down I-95 for days. Nobody saw that coming, couldn't manage that one day out. So let's now have bureaucrat economists run all kinds of black box models that are not transparent to be able to control capital flows and allow the government to control capital flows to impact weather or with the goal of impacting weather in 50 years. It's quite ridiculous when you think about the track record of the Fed and government in the near term with very much more manageable short-term issues and then expecting them to be even remotely successful when it comes to massive and massively complicated issues decades and decades on out into the future. But there you have it. And speaking of inflation in the context of the Fed, what's inflation been doing? It's now at a 40-year high. That's not good. It's likely getting worse. That's even more concerning. And as inflation goes up, the president's approval ratings go down. Not surprising that that's an inverse correlation. So now President Biden and some in Congress, what are they doing? They're, of course, engaging in a blame game as to what the causes of inflation are rooted in. So one area of focus inevitably is on energy prices. That's a big component of inflation because energy affects everything. And what's being alleged by President Biden and some in Congress is that oil and domestic natural gas companies are colluding. You know, they're driving the prices up under collusion, and it's corporate greed. So you know all these talking points by now. You've probably heard them. And of course, the president is making a public outreach to the FTC to investigate that type of thing. What's interesting about this is his predecessor and his prior boss, President Obama, he went on record saying that electricity prices would, quote, necessarily skyrocket, end quote, under his proposed climate policies. So you had President Obama going on the record saying that energy prices are going to skyrocket if you follow the climate policies that he was proposing and that were sort of tame compared to what President Biden and some in Congress are proposing today. You've got Bank of America that did a study that said net zero carbon globally by 2050 is going to cost a mere $150 trillion over 30 years. That's two times the annual gross GDP of every nation on Earth. What do you think that's going to do to inflation? Then you've got meat prices. This is tied, of course, to food, probably sort of is equally right concerning when it comes to inflation as energy, because again, everybody eats. And once again, politicians, what are they doing? They're blaming corporate greed and consolidation, all that stuff that's going on the business side. President Biden and his administration, they were outlining tighter regulations for U.S. meat packers, and they're basically accusing the industry of inflating Americans' food bills. But, you know, the meat packers and the meat companies, what are they saying? Well, they've got experiencing and they're seeing consistent and persistent supply chain problems, labor shortages, right? Feed, packing, transport costs, energy costs are going up because why is energy drive sort of food prices and meat prices? Meat is a commodity. It's a very energy intensive endeavor to basically raise the cattle and provide the meat. If energy costs go up, meat prices inevitably are going to go up. So there was an interesting quote here from President Biden. Quote, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation. That's what we're seeing in poultry in those industries now. Small independent farmers and ranchers are being driven out of business, end quote. This was a quote that the president had when he's holding a virtual meeting with farmers and ranchers to talk about, you know, this issue of meat costs. And he's right. But what he's missing, of course, and what's left unsaid is when you want to find the root causes that's causing this exploitation and what's driving these small farmers and ranchers out of business, it's not corporate America, right? It's not collusion in the private sector. I think you need to look in the mirror at the root causes. It's supply chain strangulation via government policy. It's energy scarcity via government and climate change policy. It's inflation, right? It's intended inflation via government policy. And it's lower work participation and employment participation via government policy. So if you want to look to the root causes of what's causing energy prices to go up and what's causing food prices to go up and why inflation's at a 40-year high, if you're a politician in the Biden administration or a bureaucrat, or if you're a politician in Congress that was embracing a lot of these leftist types of policies, pick up a mirror and give it a look. I think you'll find your root causes. Now, as President Biden's approval ratings are dropping because of inflation rising, the rate of decline of his approval ratings, I think it's only rivaled by the declining credit scores of people carrying student loan college debt. Student loan debt right now, $1.7 trillion. That's almost $40,000 per student or per person carrying the debt. Huge swaths of these people are in deferred payment plans or in default late payments. And why is all this happening? Because tuition costs keep skyrocketing for college. And why is that happening? Well, big reason, right? Besides government subsidization creating a price bubble, which we've talked about before on the Far Middle, the other big reason is that the growth of the university administrative state has just been exponential, and that jacks up tuition costs. Now, a while ago, we talked about six recommendations on an episode of the Far Middle that would help get the country back on the right track. And one of those, if you recall, was demanding that universities and colleges recognize that their business model is broken and that they're failing in their charter duties, right? Their fiduciary duties, so to speak, their missions, and that they were afforded certain benefits and protections in exchange for fulfilling their duties and their models. That was the original deal. Now, students are being swindled of billions of dollars in excessive tuition, and taxpayers are ending up subsidizing higher education more and more. And university endowments, right, they're massive, they're as big as they've ever been, and colleges effectively pay no taxes. So you add all these up, there should be, I think, a very logical, rational demand that any student loan forgiveness, that it be paid out of the university endowments first until there's no endowment. So we should exhaust that source of funding and payment and restitution at the start. The endowment, when you think about it, was created and provided special rules for it, right, with the assumption that the system was going to work. And it's now broken. There's no accountability tied to fixing it. If the university is cheating the kid and breached its sort of contractual social duty and responsibility and mission, and there's no desire to reform or to fix it, then it should pay the restitution, not the student and certainly not the taxpayer. Now, I rehashed this recommendation because I saw two data points that really illustrated how broken and off course higher education is these days, particularly elite higher education. The first data point deals with Navient, which is a private lending entity. They recently reached an agreement to cancel $1.7 billion in student loans. This was part of an agreement they reached with a number of states, I want to say almost 40 states. The settlement resulted from accusations that the lender was giving out loans to millions of borrowers who would be unlikely to be able to repay the loans. So the quote from somebody that is an advocate for this settlement said that, quote, at long last, the student loan borrowers who had been forced to shoulder the burden of dangerous and predatory private student loans made by Sallie Mae and owned by Navient will finally be debt-free, end quote. This was coming from the executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center. Not exactly. I don't think I agree with that statement at all. So here you have the left, or entities that are basically soundboards for the left, that are going after private lenders like Navient, which, by the way, Navient was created out of government-controlled lenders like Sallie Mae. But nevertheless, you're going after the entities like Navient and basically accusing them of predatory lending. But what about going after the true perpetrators of the defrauding that's occurring of these students and their parents and their taxpayers when it comes to, once again, extortive college tuition and the overhyped values of these college degrees? In other words, what about going after colleges and universities themselves who took that money when those loans were made? They continually jack up tuition. They don't produce degrees often that are worth a rate of return in the real economy or in the private sector. Let's, again, hold the root cause core perpetrators accountable, and sooner or later, the problem will be fixed if you do so. So this settlement with Navient, despite what the executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center said, this settlement does neither. It doesn't create accountability. It doesn't hold the root cause core perpetrators accountable. And thus, the problem's going to continue. It's not only not going to be fixed, it's going to continue and gets worse. Which brings me to the second data point that I saw out there, which really highlights maybe a rehash of that recommendation when it comes to university endowments. I saw that Yale now has as many non-teaching staff as they do undergraduate students. So the non-teaching staff, this is everything from diversity officers, Title IX managers, sustainability officers, wellness coordinators, all these different types of areas and disciplines. And unfortunately, oftentimes, none of these areas, positions, and jobs, and bureaucrats significantly help diversity, safety, or student health. All of them inevitably add to the bloat and to the excess and add to tuition and reduce rate of return of a degree investment and dilute quality. And I'd expect many of these schools, whether it's, you know, Yale or Princeton or Cornell, and I think Princeton and Cornell are two examples where they're going to go remote again at the start of spring semester, right? Here we are in early February, which will once again dilute and soften the educational experience. But guess what? When it comes to the tuition bills, they'll demand the same level of tuition that they always have. So they dilute the product, but there's no corresponding offset when it comes to the cost or the price of the product. This is all nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. It is time for reform. It's not going to come. Reform will not come from the insider. It has to come from the funders, which are you and me, taxpayers, parents, students, all of us. Well, there goes episode 37 of the Far Middle Podcast. These things always fly. Already thinking about some of the topics and subjects for our next episode, number 38. And I hope you enjoyed it. If you get a chance, pre-order Precipice, the book, if you haven't already, The Less Campaign to Destroy America. Once again, you can do that on Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, Amazon.com. Publication should be arriving at your door mid-March. And if you get a chance, check me out on Twitter, at Nick Deolius. It's been fun lately participating in a Twitter sphere. It's been very active. Give it a look if you get a chance. And then there's nickdeolius.com, the website, always posting new commentary, some new in the news postings, also some blogs about what's going on with our mentorship academy at CNX. Some really interesting things and exciting things. I think you'd be intrigued to give it a look if you get a chance and get a couple of minutes to invest. Enjoy your early February. Talk to you soon.